top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
Welcome to episode 350 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. Movies Jeff and I didn't exactly warm to. We use that descriptor, but you can use the sobriquet overrated, if you will. But we don't find the term overrated particularly too useful. Instead, these are movies that we acknowledge that are good and that we feel damn nigh guilty about not maybe gushing over effusively. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to try and put words in Jeff's mouth, and while he's not here, in the interest of this discussion, spurred by how mystified I was continually on social media seeing the adulation and near unanimity of a claim garnered by the South Korean film Train to Busan, for example. Well, I figured I would solicit Jeff's opinion during some downtime at work, which I did. We actually narrowed it down to a few choice movies that, you know, for lack of a better term, are overrated or ones we couldn't find that we could quite glean onto for whatever reason. So we narrowed it down to these. This is a pretty off the top of my dome impromptu cast here, but I'll try and gather my thoughts the best I can. The first one is Train to Busan. Train to Busan, it should be said that I guess Jeff is not overly keen on the likes of, let's say, 28 Days Later, and wanted to include actually that film in today's discussion. I, however, countered, and I think that if you're going to do a fast zombie conceit, far removed from a George Romero undead shuffler, you're best to build a movie around it in which that type of zombie is almost de-emphasized at the expense of, in the case of 28 Days Later, gobs and gobs, oodles and copious amounts of just amazing atmosphere. It's just a ruined cityscape, and London is rendered as an apocalyptic hellhole worthy of some parts of Buffalo or Detroit. I kid. No, but London has never looked so amazing in film, and to see it utterly and so convincingly transformed. I really do like the way 28 Days Later handled a zombie-slash-apocalyptic type hybrid film. I think it was pretty decent on that front, though I could see why someone could take umbrage with that if they want to keep their zombies more on the side of more of a corpse instead of, you know, a Usain Bolt coming after you. But with Train to Busan, by contrast, doesn't even make great use of the special limitations of that particular type of conveyance. I mean, you can look at, let's say, Wes Craven's Red Eye as a kind of masterclass, I think, in aviation terror and claustrophobia. It's a really, really well-crafted, even though that's maybe more of a thriller, not a true horror. You can even look at the Jamie Lee Curtis, she stars in that 80s vehicle called Terror Train, and the antagonist there in that film is skulking about sleeping compartments and killing people off. I mean, that's pretty scary, right? Like, Terror Train, as cheesy as it is, I mean, it has David Copperfield doing corny magic on it and stuff, but it makes far better use of terror on the tracks and will especially resonate with you if you've done one of those long, arduous, overnight train journeys like I did back in Thailand, going from the south and the north of the country, or very memorably with a bunch of drunk Russian snorers on the way back to Germany from Budapest, Hungary. This was a real eye-opener, and maybe many other things maybe, but the belching and the snoring combo made for quite a long and ugly, gross ride, let me tell you. So, you know, be wary of which bunk you're sleeping in when you're in one of those trains. But a train to Busan has speed zombies on a speed train, you know? I mean, really, like, who gives a toss? Who gives a rat's hindquarters, really, if zombies are fast or whether they're really slow if you're stuck on a moving train? I mean, isn't that the point? So you can't exacerbate or accentuate or amplify the tension if you're already stuck on something. Like, you could have one person moving at 2 miles an hour and it wouldn't matter because there's only so many trains, and you got your caboose and wherever. You can't jump off, you're stuck. So, I mean, having them be fast in a confined space, I mean, let's just say that got old, pardon the pun, really, really fast. Also, I found the movie had a strange, almost a feel of a video game, and not in a good way, like the splendid, the transcendent action film Old Boy, speaking of South Korean film. And speaking of conveyances and journeying overland, let's take a jaunt over to Europe now. And that brings us to the next film, Suspiria. Suspiria, the original, 1977, is a neon-infused and almost, one might say, effervescent Dario Argento. I mean, hell, you have to call it a classic. And that movie, I mean, I remember seeing it when I was quite young, and it resonates with me to this day. I usually watch it once a year, but it's best known for its color scheme. I mean, something the maestro replicated in efforts like Inferno, which is kind of underrated in a way, but which is why it's really mystifying that Luca Guadagnino, the director of the 2018 iteration of the film, decided to opt for muted, drab, gray hues as a design, a color aesthetic. Like, if people go gaga over like a spate of kills, countless, endless, multiple kills in Friday the 13th, would you somehow reboot the franchise by putting Jason alone with a victim and having him chase one victim around for like 90 minutes? But it's not just about like aesthetic choices in Suspiria. I mean, like, it really drags on, and apart from a few instances showcasing what maybe the Germans would call unheimlich, like a sense of not just terror and dread, but overarching unease. It's something that was, I think, lacking in the Berlin set, modern-ish. Well, I guess it was a 70s time frame in the reboot of the Suspiria, but like, it just didn't have either the sense of like quirky weirdness or dread, or it didn't take you to another place in the way that the original did. It just kept it in the here and now, and it was almost kind of made it banal in a way, and I don't know if that was intentional. That plus the stunt casting of like triplicate Tilda Swinton, like, for no reason. Like, I didn't totally notice it at first, but then I started to notice it, and it took me out of the picture a little bit. Picture, like, what am I, some sort of 1930s MGM executive? But all right, this picture is not so good. But no, like, also setting it in the 70s, I believe it's a historical period, the post-war Berlin, that's alien to many people, not the least of which me, and I have German blood, and it kind of landed with a thud to set it there and then have allusions to other things. It just didn't, it seemed a little bit sort of too art film on the one hand. And whilst the original 1977 flick had Italian prog rock group Goblin handling musical duties, the update had Tom York from Radiohead doing the score, and like, while he looks like a goblin, like, it bleep and bloops are ineffectual and kind of lame, to be frank. And like, well, 2018 had a mesmerizing dance sequence. I mean, the 2018 Suspiria, really, so does Saturday Night Fever, right? Next, Get Out and Us. I mean, Jordan Peele is pretty hilarious, at least with Key and Peele. And if you're an NFL or college college football fan of the gridiron, you've got to check out the relentlessly repetitive but riotous player introductions, send up, and sketch that the twosome does. It's just so great. And Jordan Peele shows unbelievable promise as a horror director, really, though not as much as I would argue as Brandon Cronenberg, Son of David, with his stunning Possessor and Antifa, great debut. But so let's maybe stop falling over ourselves, heaping plaudits on both Get Out and Us. I mean, both these films suffer from the same, I think, two maladies. That is, there's very little to hang your hat on once narratively. Like, right off the bat, as Peele shows his hand so early, the sophomore effort is worse, as in Us, that one, a family meets its evil doppelgangers. Say that three times fast. Family meets its evil doppelgangers, and it turns into some blah home invasion flick, and with nowhere to go after 40 minutes, 30 minutes in. And it's like, similarly, I think Get Out suffers in that it doesn't have the gradual, pull you in narrative revelations like the, I guess you could argue, somewhat equally overhyped Midsommar, but it destroys whatever natural empathy, sympathy you might have with the black man and the limousine liberal racist family. But it's just too obvious, and right out of the gate, it's telegraphed, even if the end has an almost phantasm-esque, if you haven't seen it, that's, you know, a spoiler, but the ending is pretty terrific, but it just doesn't cohesively hold well together, despite a lot of promise early on. And Midsommar, for all it's being somewhat overhyped too, at least has some really stunning scenes in it. Like, I'd say three really bona fide horror scares in it, even though I don't feel that one totally materialized to the way it could have done. But I think that was slightly, if I had to rank the two, I'd put Midsommar slightly ahead, by virtue of just the sheer novelty of something set in some weird Swedish hippie commune. But it'd be interesting to see what Jordan Peele does with, or rather what he does to, the Candyman property as producer, because the new Candyman obviously is coming, if not already here. So far the reviews are solid, however, a caveat, I feel like people will be almost compelled to say they like it, just because there's so much goodwill toward, I mean, obviously it's great to see a black director working in the horror space, but I feel like Candyman, like, there's a wealth of social commentary in the first film, so I mean, we'll see what they do to it. There's a tendency in horror to ruin famous properties. I mean, I'm looking at you, Black Christmas, but let's hope it, at the very least, it encourages people to see both Candyman films. Oh, the Candyman can, for sure, say his name, right? Scream, like other films on this list, I mean, it's decent, it's really well made, and it's above average. I mean, granted, it really is. However, where we take umbrage is, instead of taking the kind of humor we prefer, like a gallows approach, like Tucker and Dale versus Evil or Reanimator, or it takes pot shots at the horror genre and is self-referential and doesn't particularly do it with in any way that's particularly spectacular. Let's be honest, it's not overly hilarious. And though Wes Craven can't be faulted, what Scream left in its wake was a bunch of to varying degrees slyly ironic horrors, and to this day there's seemingly no end to these types of films, whether it's Netflix's series Fear Street or maybe Happy Death Day to You. It's that knowing distanced winking, it's that Tarantino tends to too heavily lean on, in my opinion, that makes it a bit unbearable. But it's nice to see in horror, especially from the 80s, things that are self-contained and with their own lore, like creating their own lore. Like, let's say, Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, it's so much more resistant to becoming dated when you do that, and you create your own milieu, you create your own universe. I mean, pop culture references, when they're not broadly targeted, become old very, 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 very fast. I mean, it's quite ridiculous. And for all the positives, I mean, Scream Sydney is a pretty, pretty good protagonist and a pretty great female role model in horror, but nothing like some of the ones we prefer. Like, you could throw in your Jennifer Connelly as Vera in Dario Argento's Phenomena. Donald Pleasance and that unforgettable monkey, one of the great monkeys in horrors, or chimp or whatever it is. There's also Jessica Harper as Susie Bannon in the original Suspiria, as a callback to that, obviously, but perhaps the apotheosis and the summit of the final girl heroine type is Heather Langenkamp in Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, that's a film that's far more daring, dazzling, and creepy than the oftentimes ludicrous and largely unscary Ghostface and Scream franchise, I would say, with a few exceptions. It does have some kind of pointed dialogue and some nice insights into horror tropes and whatnot, but overall I think it suffers, especially some of the sequels too. That's it for now, folks. Let us know what your favorite overhyped horror flick that is, or maybe you think the Really Awful Movies podcast is overhyped, or you maybe can't warm to us either. We'll talk to you soon, and take care. Thank you.